And welcome to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So make yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. Hello, friends, and welcome back to Speaking with Joy. I have the great pleasure this week of doing a podcast with my sister, Sarah. Say hello, Sarah.
Hello. I almost said hello, Sarah, but I
know. I always make that joke. People say that. It is actually kind of astounding to me that I have not yet done, I don't think I featured you on the normal podcast at all yet, and we haven't done together, which is ridiculous.
This is far overdue then.
But the great thing about being able to live in Oxford a good bit of this year is that I get to be down the street from Sarah, and so we thought we have to record a podcast together.
Absolutely.
So we were brainstorming what we wanted to do, and we came up with several many different things. Options. Yeah. We're like, what about this one? And we thought, okay, well, I guess it just means we'll have to do more in the future. But we landed on something that we both have a mutual love of, something that has enriched both of our hearts and our lives and our imaginations, and something we thought might be a new interest and delight for you all. And that is on Celtic things. How else would you put that? Celticness?
Celticness, Celtic prayer, Celtic music. Ways of seeing the world, Celtic yes. music. I think we've both been quite shaped by.
Indeed we have.
By Celtic strains.
And just so you know, Celtic is kind of a mysterious term because usually people use it in reference to Ireland, but yes. Celtic could actually mean, it was more of the Celtic people were
I mean, it
Scotland,
kind of encompasses Scotland, Ireland,
Northern England,
of, yeah, Wales and Cornwall and yes, and yes. also I must note this because I did a paper on this uh-huh. and I would have gotten graded down if I hadn't gotten this right. The Celtic Church was not distinct from the larger
no.
church of the medieval world, but it no. was part of it. But it had a particular
flavor.
Way of seeing
yes.
That participated in the larger church, but
indeed.
I think is what is special about it.
Absolutely. So we are so excited to talk about this today. And I feel like I remember when I moved to Scotland to do my master's at St. Andrews, I remember I put together a playlist for myself of Celtic music that we grew up loving.
Get you in the
and just oh, just
the
longing,
soundtrack
yeah,
for
getting
your...
ready for it. And then getting there and really being in Scotland has it has not disappointed my love of Celtic things. You know, we had this love as children and as a family, but it has really expanded and grown it. So before we get started, why don't I say, when did you begin to enjoy the Celtic kind of ethos, whether that was in music or in prayers or in writing? When was that for you?
I think it built for me. So I think one of the first times I was consciously aware of it, and I'll talk about this music today, but mm-hmm. was, I think I was 8 years old when I heard a song done by Lorena McKennitt, and mm-hmm. it was, I can't remember, it was a traditional song of some sort, and I remember there was a longing and a sense of mystery in it that tugged at my little 8-year-old mm-hmm. heart, and I just wanted to go over and listen to it again.
Mm-hmm.
I think the album was given to my dad as a gift, but I quickly hijacked it, and so I think that kind of piqued my initial interest, and then I think I was probably late teens, somewhere in there, when I discovered Celtic Daily Prayer,
mm-hmm.
Which was a book put out by the Northumbria community, which is based on the ancient Holy Isle of Lindisfarne. It's a community that's kind of reclaimed one of the ancient Celtic.
Is that the one just off of Scotland's coast?
Just off the coast of Scotland.
So
yeah,
I think
you can still
I,
go there.
I think I have trained by the
yes.
the town that goes to the ferry that goes to the island.
And it's, I think it's a community very much trying to revive kind of the ideas and the ethos of the Celtic communities in the earlier days of the church. But I started doing this using this prayer book that I picked up at a conference, and I remember thinking, what is this? And I was curious, and I was immersed in this world of liturgical prayer, which that was new to me to begin with. But then also it was rich in imagery and symbol and talked about nature. And I encountered the St. Patrick's breastplate, where he calls on the stars to be his companions and, you know, his walk with Christ, and for the rocks to protect him and the lightning and the thunder.
Yes.
And it was this whole encompassing of the whole world within prayer. And it was
very cosmological.
Very much so. And I think that I had always had this sense as a child that the world spoke and the world sang with the presence of God. And Celtic prayer finally gave me a way to articulate
a language
and to
that.
Enter into it on a spiritual plane. So I think that, and then I've gone farther. I think I started
yes.
there and then have just journeyed.
I've always wondered, because, you know, for me it's much the same. In a funny way, my first memory of, you spoke of being kind of like drawn to
yeah.
the ethos, especially in the music. And for me, really sillily, it was because I remember singing, you know, oh, you'll take the high road. And I remember as a little girl,
indeed,
I was the youngest, and so I'd often kind of entertain myself little things. And I remember sitting, we're driving the mountains, and singing that little song to myself in the back. And I had this little, I don't think mom got it as like, as to be Celtic, but she had me this little kind of plaid skirt.
I remember this cute little skirt. Yeah, I remember that
And I remember sitting in the back and singing it to myself and thinking about how forlorn it was that the love was on the other side of the ocean and loving my little skirt.
Isn't it interesting that the sadness in Celtic music is part of it? It gives voice to something.
I felt very moved by it as a very little, I mean, I was probably four.
Yeah.
And I remember just feeling really drawn by it. And there was something about the mixture of the forlornness, the love of nature.
Yes.
And, you know, when I was older, I began to say, oh, part of the reason I love the Celtic music is because a lot of it is in the Ionian scale. You know, you have majors and minors.
Yes, that's most of our stuff. You can begin to actually recognize what's going on.
But then the Ionian scale is one that's kind of like in between major and minor, so it makes you long,
Which I think in some ways is kind of goes with Celtic history, kind of living on these borderlands. And I remember reading Madeleine Ingle talking about her trip to Iona, which is another reclaimed old Celtic community.
And I'll talk about that today, too, as well.
Oh, good. And saying it was a thin place, like a place where kind of heaven and earth mingled. And I think there's a reality to that in the way that Celtic peoples think about the world.
Well, I know. And I remember just feeling so drawn to that. And then you passed on Celtic daily prayer to me. And that was actually the first place that I really encountered personally, like a more liturgical way of praying, where I had readings every day and I had prayers for different kinds. And different kinds of seasons. And so there's just a lot of richness there. And I've wondered sometimes if part of the reason that you and I connect to it so much is because I don't think that everyone necessarily does. Although I feel like everyone
should. We will argue today why you should.
Absolutely. But I've also wondered if part of it is because we are, by heritage, Scottish and Irish.
I have wondered that as well.
Like, if
I remember I used to read about biographies of George MacDonald, and he was described as having the soul of a Celt, and I thought,
I think I did too.
Have the soul of a Celt.
I know, or like, this is a random thing, but it's kind of like, you know, in the movie Everything is Illuminated, when he goes back and he doesn't realize that this is his family,
but then
when he responds to the Jewish, it's because he realizes, oh, I am Jewish, and I had it there. And I felt kind of that way about Celtic things. There was this kind of...
Maybe there's this aspect. Yeah. Though, I think the Celtic viewpoint has something to say to the modern world in general, which is why I think it's...
Yes, absolutely.
The whole Celtic world is popular in a funny sort of way.
Well, and I think sometimes you almost have like a hauntedness that it draws you back inside and you go, oh, this is how I'm meant to experience the world.
Yes.
This draws me to worship God. Okay, well, if we never actually start talking about our examples today, we'll just go on and on about our love of Celtic things. So today we are going to explore the wonder of the Celtic way with you, and to introduce you to its way of seeing the world as charged with the grandeur and beauty of God, and to maybe give you some resources to explore it yourself. So today we'll be doing three examples, as we always do in this podcast, one visual, one literary, and one musical. Today, our visual one, it's kind of a crossover between visual and literary, we'll be talking about the illuminated manuscripts of the Irish scribes and how they actually contributed to saving Western civilization in some ways.
Large order.
I know, it is a large order. Then we'll be talking about the Celtic kind of way of prayer and looking at Celtic daily prayer, some other mystics, and then the Carmina Gedelica.
Carmina Gedelica. I have no idea if we're saying that correctly, but that is how it looks to me.
Yes, and we'll be giving you some kind of resources for if you wanted to learn some of these beautiful prayers. And then finally, we'll be looking at the haunting music of Lorena McKennett.
Lorena McKennett, indeed.
So without further ado, let us dive into the first example, which is a visual one about the illuminated manuscripts of Ireland. Now, I've done a similar podcast on this, not on this specifically, but on related things, and on specifically on the Book of Kells. So if you're interested in that, you can go and find Turning Darkness into Light as kind of a further deeper insight into this, but I'm so excited to share with you about this. Now, there is this very specific kind of art that comes out of Ireland between the 6th and the 9th century. There are these beautiful illuminated manuscripts. Now, what an illuminated manuscript is it's usually a gospel or a psalms, so a book of those, and it's written and, you know, so you have the words, usually in Latin. But then it has these illuminations, which are this kind of particular kind of lettering and styling where it's beautiful, where there's figures. So if you're reading the Gospels,
incredibly intricate.
Very intricate. So if you're reading the Gospels, there might be, before the opening, it might be this beautiful mm-hmm. kind of almost painting, but it was kind of drawn with pens yeah. of Christ. And woven into these, I'm kind of describing it to you and then I'll give you its history, are these intricate, you can hardly believe how vivid, how connected, how delicate designs are. And then all of this imagery of nature.
I always feel like the whole world is drawn into a Celtic manuscript. There's this sense in which
yes.
the words are framed by the whole world.
Absolutely. And I'm looking at the cover of the Book of Kells. Mm-hmm. And it's Christ seated and he's got the gospel in his hand. I think that's Christ. It might be John. I'm questioning myself. But you've got these two peacocks over and all this beautiful kind of intricately wound things, and it's beautiful, but it's also very symbolic because you have the peacocks, which represent resurrection, and
I think anyway, everything means
everything in both the Celtic means and the something. Yeah, book and it's this combination. What's beautiful about it is it's the combination of word and of image, and that those things.
Word and world.
Yes, word and world, and that they are bound together closely. So you have this very specific, beautiful kind of artwork that comes out of this era in Ireland, but there's a very specific history behind it. And some might say that very specific history was part of what is responsible for us being able to have knowledge of classical texts, of the Bible, and the things during the kind of dark ages after the sacking of Rome. So let me tell you a bit of that story. So in 410, as you may have learned in your history books, the Visigoths sacked Rome. And it was the first time in 800 years, this will connect to Ireland, it was the first time in 800 years that Rome had fallen to a foreign enemy, and it really shook the world. So Rome, obviously, its empire had expanded, and it was had its fingers in everywhere from Africa to England. It was huge. And
there wasn't like the Pax Romana, so that sense of this peace that came to the world
yes.
with the rule of Rome.
Yeah,
to an extent.
I was going to say, the peace that was, you might say that they had conquered and subdued.
Yes.
And so
there was
a subdued peace because you were under the thumb of Rome. But they suddenly found themselves under attack, and this had huge ramifications for European culture and history. And that's because not only did Rome bring peace, it also brought words.
Mm.
And part of that is because
words could travel.
They could. And Rome was a literate society. Latin became, at first it was Greek during a certain era. That was kind of the language of everywhere. But Latin became the language, obviously, of the Roman Empire. And it was what you had these classical texts in. But then Christians eventually adopted it and started using it for a lot of the church fathers, right, yeah, Sarah?
It became kind of the common tongue.
And so that was a kind of one of the gifts of Rome, even as it conquered and killed Christians. They also used it to spread the gospel because you had this common language all over the empire. Yeah. So as the barbarians were destroying Rome, part of the fear was not just that they would conquer Rome, it was that they would lose the wisdom and the words that had been preserved in Latin. And this happened. People just went around burning libraries, losing things, and there was this great destruction, not only of landmarks and of beautiful places, but of words.
Libraries.
And so if that had gone on, a lot of the things that we have today, whether that's Homer or all these different things, they would have just been destroyed.
The words that make us a people in many ways in the modern world.
Exactly. So this is where the Irish came in. And there's a wonderful book called How the Irish Saved Civilization. Have you read this?
I actually haven't, but I've heard enough about it.
And I actually haven't read all of it. I haven't read all of it, so I will own up to that. And, you know, they say part of it's a little bit idealized, but it's also fairly true. So what happened was when Patrick came to Ireland around 430, so this is right after the sacking of Rome, and the sacking of Rome, it took a long time to, you know, totally take Rome out because it was a pretty big empire. But around a similar time, when Patrick came, he brought not only the gospel, but the alphabet. Because the Irish had been an oral culture, which meant that they passed on their laws, their religious beliefs,
their poetry,
all of these things.
And a center figure in that culture was the bard, was the person who passed on those oral, which in a minute.
Well, and so, you know, where we have the lawyers in our world who kind of parse out the text and everything, they had the poets who, because they composed the mist and they remembered everything.
It's a communal memory.
It was the person that you went to. Keepers. So when Patrick came, he brought not only the gospel, but the alphabet. And so all of a sudden, this nation had access to being able to write down its myths, stories. Its stories, its beliefs, its laws. Mm-hmm. And there, I'm going to read you this quote from a writer called Bella Schumann. And she writes, "The Irish have always loved words. In the pre-Christian era, when the literary and legal traditions of the country were committed to memory rather than parchments, jurists and poets were men of high status." So that's what she's saying, the bard.
Yes.
"The legal text of this narrative tradition, once written down, filled many thick volumes. The poetry filled many, many more. We have no manuscript of these texts before 700, but it seems certain that the Irish accepted the Roman alphabet and habit of consulting written authority when they accepted Christianity. The religion of the book brought the arts of the pen."
Hmm.
So that's her way of kind of saying that as soon as Patrick comes, there begins to be this flourishing of manuscripts.
Hmm.
They began to write everything they could get their hands on. First, they wrote their own things. They wrote down their myths. They wrote down about, you know, things kind of, they would mix the pagan and the, they didn't mix the pagan and the Christian. A lot of times, I think this is something people understand when they'll be like, well, maybe there's things in Christmas that has pagan histories. But what a lot of Irish, and this also happened in places like Iceland and Norway, is they saw the pagan myths that they had as being answered by Christ.
Which I think it's worth saying is how C.S. Lewis viewed them as well.
Yeah.
He saw Christ as the myth became fact, the one true myth to which every other myth pointed in a way. And so in some ways, I think those Christian practices were unafraid of embracing
Absolutely.
The local myths that had
given it was kind of like this culmination. And so like it's like he says, I can't remember what this is, but he talks about Baldur, who I think,
Baldur
is the Norse, right?
Yes.
So Baldur's the Norse god, I think, and he dies and rises again. And he said, I read about that. And then I was like, oh my gosh, this but was
there
like...
There is an actual dying god.
Yes. And so anyway, so they very much received that. So in a lot of these writings, you see them kind of working their worldview with Christ in mind.
Yes.
But they also wrote down lots of other things. You had these monastic traditions, and one of them started with St. Columba, who founded Iona. Which is what we were talking about before. And that's off of Scotland, also off Scotland. It's kind of in between Scotland and Ireland on the west coast, right?
West coast, yep.
And in these monasteries, while Europe was burning to the ground, the Irish priests and scribes were scribbling away, writing their own histories.
Everything, histories, liturgies,
gospels. Copies of gospels. But even also classical texts, you know, Plato.
They were really keeping places of culture, I think.
Yeah.
Like bastions of what was good and beautiful.
And because they were so far north, they were a little bit separated. Now,
that's for a while.
I was going to say. And then you had them also being attacked all the time by...
And then being sacked by the Vikings.
It's actually kind of incredible that we have any of the things we have.
Yes. Though, what are you going to say about how the Book of Kells was found?
Was it found in a bog? I didn't realize that.
If I'm not getting this totally wrong.
I do not doubt it at all.
I believe the Book of Kells, which is the example we're using here, is actually found in an Irish bog, which it kind of miraculously preserved it. And the cover had been torn off by Vikings because it was jewel encrusted, basically. But the text and the illuminated manuscripts had been preserved by this unique kind of chemical reaction in the bog. Yeah, it's quite amazing.
I think you mean preserved by God.
Well, yes. Preserved by God in the bog.
Yes.
I hope I'm not totally misquoting myself.
I don't think you are. If you're not, if it's not Book of Kells, it's probably one of the other Gospels.
Good.
But yeah, so in Iona, Columba, so the Book of Kells is also known as the Book of Columkill, which means the Book of Columba. And Columba was, apparently, I didn't push this much into it, but there was 12 apostles of Ireland. Did you know this? So Patrick was one of them, and there's all these, you know, who knows if they're historic, but he was one of the very big figures. And so... supposedly, he began to create this most beautiful of all the Gospels, and it is vivid, and like I was saying, because they had this really vivid view of the world from their own culture, they began to see God as in Christ as being the fulfillment of all of their expectations, of all of their sense of the divine in nature.
In a way, they reoriented. It wasn't an overthrow of who they were.
No.
It was the fulfillment of and a reorientation of who they were. So they finally knew what they were looking for, what all this meaning was pointing towards.
And they were deeply connected to nature. And so they didn't deify nature. They went, oh my gosh, all of this
The creators.
This is the creator. And so when you look at the Book of Kells, it's the Gospels, so it's all four Gospels, but it's just beautiful, and it has this very distinctly Celtic look to it. It's not a Roman text.
No, there's an intricacy to the way that the Celtic illustration happens. I think that there's nothing else quite like it.
And so it's this, it's this just beautiful, I have this example on here of a modern day kind of redrawing of the way they would do the letters and intertwine it with God bless you in advance. Maybe not. I scared you. Anyway, so that is kind of, go look at my blog. I put in some beautiful examples from it. And this beautiful, rich tradition of illuminated manuscripts that saw words as being intertwined with worlds. Mm. And they saw and they wove all of their expectations, all of the beauty they perceived in nature, all of their kind of ancient pagan things into seeing that Christ was the fulfillment of all their hopes. And so they put their beauty into these books. And in doing that, they also preserved a lot of the riches of Christian and Western literature. That was being destroyed further down, even while they're being attacked. Amazing. And I will say, finally, that I actually got to see the Book of Kells.
I'm very jealous.
And when I saw it, it's crazy, because the Book of Kells was, when it was being created, supposedly, from their records, the abbey that it was in was actually burned down, or, like, sacked, like, 17 times in 15 years.
That's incredible.
That's, like, a lot. That's why very, very intelligent. That is quite a bit. But not only do they keep creating this beauty, they somehow manage to preserve it. And I was reading an account where, actually, this is the earliest account we have of it, which is in 1000, where they already had the completed book. Mm. And the Vikings came in and took it, and they were very upset about this. And they wrote in their little thing, they're like, oh, the Vikings have taken the Book of Columbkill. And then they found it again. The jeweled around had been taken off.
Yes.
So the Vikings
common with the Vikings.
The Vikings were not in it for the words. And I think that might have been where they were discovered again.
Yeah, okay.
But they have always been a picture to me of, this is kind of an aside. I'm sorry, I've just been blah, blah, blahing for 10 minutes. But they have always been a picture to me of, even in darkness, even in, like, when everything is constantly being destroyed, even when it seems like everything you're doing might constantly be destroyed. You create beauty and you preserve what is good.
Absolutely. You continue. It's defiant. It's a way of defying the darkness. It's to say the darkness will not be final. And I think that's what the Celts, that's part of their legacy, is this insistence upon the beautiful and upon the intricate and upon what is good
and the natural.
And what reflects the mind and imagination of the creator. That is still present in the broken world. And this is what we return to again and again. And this is what we pray. Which is,
And that will lead us into, I think, our next example, which is Celtic prayer.
Which in many ways, I think, is the liturgy of this visual, intricate, imaginative people. And I think that they had a language and a way of using words that wove the way they saw the world together. Mm. So I did actually a paper on this because here in my last year of study, because someone said, what would you study if you really want to? And I was like, well, I love Celtic prayer and I want to figure out why I love Celtic prayer.
Yeah.
And I think for me, one of the books I'll start by saying for this section, if you really are curious about this, two books, Celtic Daily Prayer by the Northern Community,
which we use.
It's a really rich resource. So it has 2 years worth of like scripture verses every day and readings, but it also has liturgies for morning prayer, evening prayer, Compline, which is something I actually read Compline aloud to my little 8-month-old Lillian. As often as I remember to. So not all the time, but I try to remember. Because I think the words are so rich and beautiful. But a way that when I kind of got interested in trying to figure out what is this Celtic prayer and what is this liturgy, there's a great book called The Celtic Way of Prayer, The Recovery of the Religious Imagination by Esther Duval. And it is a marvelous exploration of the way that the Celts prayed. And it really depends quite heavily on what we said a few minutes ago is called the Carmina Gadelica, which, as we were speaking about earlier, the Celts were very oral people. And they had traditions and poems and myths and legends passed down from generation to generation, mother to daughter, father to son. And these were kind of the inheritance of their people and of their families. And it's something that I think passed into the way they prayed as well. So they did write their prayers down in some ways, but they also continued that oral tradition
Well, and I was going to say earlier, I actually think that as much as a gift of being able to write things down is, I think you also lose things when you write them down.
It's a whole different, it's a different, it's you lose of, the dynamism of
well, of it's kind of like, word. I saw somebody the other day say about, one of my friends had not had an iPhone for a long time, and he got an iPhone again, and he said, oh, yay, now I can learn things instantly and also forget them instantly.
Yes, memory. And that's a huge part, I think, of an oral tradition, is the strengthening of memory that you have in within yourself.
Yes.
This capacity to draw forth.
Yeah, I think
the words that shape you.
I think as modern people who are very, like, information oriented, we think, well, obviously an oral tradition, orally traditional society can't be as good. You know, they're all illiterate. That's like a bad word. but surely the Celts were not illiterate in the way that we think. They had deep literacy of
memory. I think an interesting part of that, and I am speaking from a point of not having studied this deeply, so this is very much an amateur's point of view, but there's a music to words that are memorized, and I think that there's a lyric and a sense of rhythm to those words that is really helpful in as a language of prayer.
Yes.
And so the Carmina Gedelica is fascinating because there was a researcher in the about 1900. His name was, I think it's Alexander Carmichael. I hope I got that right. I did. Alexander Carmichael.
Amazing.
And he was fascinated by, he started realizing as he traveled through Scotland and Ireland and these different parts of the UK that, there were these oral prayers being passed down on the coast and in cottages and from family to family, and they were unique and they had evolved over hundreds of years. And so he made it his work to go through collecting them and to kind of keep them both in the Gaelic and then translating them into English for the modern world so that they wouldn't be lost as, you know, the advent of, you know, with mass communication. He saw them beginning to die out. But these prayers, so if you... you can actually look up the Carmina Gedelica is available online at sacred-text.com. It's a place that has a lot of the beautiful old legends and things. And if you look up Carmina Gedelica, you can see both volumes. But you can see that they're prayers that encompass the whole of life. So there was never a sense, I think, with the Celtic people that there was a spiritual aspect and a secular aspect.
Mm.
The whole of who they were. So you have is woven into the way they see the world. So you have the rune before prayer or a general supplication or there's a prayer for grace. There's a bathing prayer, a prayer for victory, an invocation for justice, an I lie in my bed prayer, a resting prayer, a house protecting prayer, a kindling prayer for the fire. And I think
battle to come, a baptism blessing. Every moment has a prayer.
And so I think that in a way I see these as this music of words that is weaving the whole world into holiness. They are seeing the whole world as suffused and shot through with the goodness of God and the presence of Christ. And I think they saw that before, in a way, I think this is one of the heritages of the Celtic way of seeing, is that that was something that it was a strength of their culture,
sensitive to.
Even in pagan times. And so when Christ came and illuminated the whole world for them, and they could say everything comes from the imagination of the Creator and points to the zenith of his beauty in Christ and teaches us how to journey well, the whole world was woven together, and their words, I think, are the reflection of that.
Well, I think as you were talking, I was thinking that it's kind of this belief that every moment deserves a beautiful prayer. Mm. Every moment deserves words that honor it.
And there's nothing outside of the holy in that sense.
Yes.
I remember, so I you know, did this paper researching this because I was just really curious about this. And the Celts, in this sense, they're very much part of the medieval way of seeing the world. So it wasn't just them who saw it this
way. And
then
Thomas Cahill, he says that a lot of what was kind of preserved in Celtic history then made its way back into Europe and kind of helped some of the medieval world gain its merriment.
Yes, I think that is so true. But it's what I think one writer I read, I think it's Thomas O'Loughlin, I think that's the writer, called A Cosmic Sacramentalism. And that the Celts had a comprehensively sacramental view of the world, and I'm quoting him here, whether walking, working, reading, or praying, one was always in two worlds. The physical was interpenetrated by and revealing the spiritual. One could take all that entered the mind as both real and as the shimmering image of the higher and heavenly world. And so nothing in their lives was without meaning. So to kindle a fire wasn't just to do something with matter that had no meaning. It was to participate in the kindling action of God himself and the spirit who kindles life in the human heart and the God who brings forth the dawn. Your little hearth fire was a reflection of that. But I'll just have to read you briefly one of these. This is one of my favorite prayers from the Carmina Gedelica. It's called The Lightener of the Stars. Behold the lightener of the stars on the crest of the clouds and the choralists of the sky, lauding him. Coming down with acclaim from the Father above, harp and lyre of song sounding to him. Christ, thou refuge of my love, why should not I raise thy fame? Angels and saints melodious singing to thee. Thou son of the Mary of graces, of exceedingly white purity of beauty, joy were it to me to be in the fields of thy riches. O Christ, my beloved, O Christ of the holy blood, by day and by night I praise thee. Mm. And it's this rich linguistic heritage of prayer, of a way of, I think, speaking the world, singing it into holiness. And I think it's something that we, in our modern world, we look at the world through such a view of materialism. We've inherited that in the modern age.
Things are just cogs and machines. Yeah. We treat them as dead.
The material world is just stuff. And so, and even our bodies, in a sense, are stuff. Mm. And the real stuff is the spiritual. And that is such a profoundly unincarnational way of seeing. Mm. And I think that part of the reason that we are drawn in the modern world to things like Celtic prayer, Celtic mythology, Celtic, you know, ideas of beauty is because they help to reorient and re-enchant, I think, in a way, the way we see the material, the way we see really the stuff of our ordinary lives, so that we can see our actions in ordering our homes and in creating beauty and in speaking, you know, a good night prayer to a child as actually participating in something meaningful and eternal and really, I think, rooted in the heart and person of God. And I think that, to me, is one of the great gifts of this language, the Celtic language of prayer.
I love that. And I think that something I was thinking about while you're talking is how outward looking it is. You know, when you're praying this, you're not looking into the depths of your heart and going,
very different.
What's happening in my heart?
Yeah, I think that came later.
Well, I say it did come later because I've been thinking a lot about how we've shifted from when we think about spiritual formation.
Yes.
And how this is saying, I look at nature, I look at Christ, I look at Mary, I look at the saints, and that, in turn, as I praise, will change my insides.
Yes. I think somewhere in her book, the Esther de Waal book, I think she talks about how, for the Celts, they're always praying in company. There's always a host of the kin king folk of heaven around them.
Well, and you're not sitting and just kind of, it's not just a dwelling on all of the feelings inside of my heart.
Yes.
It's a looking outward, a seeing God in creation, and that begins to change my own heart.
How do I join?
And it makes me think of a great inheritor, this is just random, but a great inheritor of the tradition in some ways is Gerard Manley Hopkins. Because
I think very much so.
You know, he said, he has his famous poem where he says, the world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil.
And interestingly, I think that has that, sorry, you should keep going.
No.
It has that internal rhythm. It has that that sing-song beauty of almost something that
you
is
you remember it. I only read it a few times before it started to make its way into my head because it's so beautiful. But I love that image of the world is charged. I don't know if this is what he meant, but in my mind, I always thought of charged like when something's charged with electricity and you touch it and it goes, it'll flame out like shining from sugar foil. And it's the sense that everything you touch, everything you see in the world is charged with that electricity of God's presence.
Nothing is void. Nothing is
void. And I think that for me, I don't know if you'd say this as well, but kind of engaging in some of the more Celtic prayer and thinking through these was kind of a way of helping me recharge the world with that grandeur.
Absolutely. To re-enchant, I think, for me.
Well,
I think in some ways even to return, because I think as a child, I had this deep sense, like when I was in my grandmother's backyard in rural Texas, it felt like the whole world was peopled with with presence, and that the trees meant something, and that the thunderstorms were speaking something.
Yeah.
But the Celts actually give voice to that, and their prayers reflect that as an actual reality.
Yes, and I think there's a quote in one of our favorite authors, Wendell Berry, I think it's in Life is a Miracle, where he says that there's this old principle in physics that if you treat something like a system, it will appear to be a system. And he says, if you treat the world like a machine, it will appear to be a machine.
Yeah.
If you treat it like it's a dead thing, it will die. And so as we've lost the ability to perceive the world as charged with the grandeur of God, we then literally can't perceive it in the world. So we kind of need something to retrain our eyes to see it.
We literally need to be healed in a way. And I think language has the capacity to heal.
Yes. And so that's why I think it's a really useful and good thing to invest in some of these prayers and in some of these things to be able to to be able to reignite that, to recharge
very
that. And this, I had a kind of random discussion question for you, Sarah, because I was thinking about this along the way. I think that in the scribes' time, you know, in Ireland, we needed people to preserve things in writing because they were losing that. by the scads, you know.
Yeah.
But in some ways, I feel like in our time, we have almost an over access to information.
I was going to say information particularly.
We have...
sound bites of knowledge.
Yeah, sound bites of knowledge. But I almost feel like we have lost the oral. We lost what they had, which was the ability to recall and to recall words that shaped the way they saw the world.
I think we're largely losing the inscape of the person.
Yes.
Of the capacity to have an interior world in which we sit with words, in which we're formed by ideas, in which we can sit in silence and, mm-hmm. and sit and be formed by the words we take in.
Absolutely. And so I have a feeling that perhaps to be a scribe in our world, to preserve the goodness of the things in the past would not be to scribble down all of the Western classics. It would be to recover these kinds of ways of seeing the world.
To recover sight, I think.
To recover sight.
To see.
And to recover hearing. I know it's funny, but like to be able...
It's almost like to recover our spiritual senses, I think.
Yes.
To revive them.
We need to maybe stop their swoon. We need to maybe stop sometimes being saturated in information and be given things that we remember, things that we see with, things that we hear with.
I completely agree.
Oh, speaking of things that we hear, our next example. So, lead the way, Sarah.
Oh, okay.
Feel free.
Well, similarly to Joy having her moment of singing her Scottish song, I think, in the back of the car.
Yes.
I can keenly remember being 8 years old and someone gave my dad this Celtic CD by this woman named Lorena McKennitt. And I listened to this song and it immediately made my heart fill with yearning. I wanted to make everybody be quiet and I wanted to sit close to the radio and just listen to
this moment.
This is holy. And I think that it was just a collection, interestingly. It was actually her her first debut CD, called Elemental by Lorena McKennitt. And it's actually a collection of traditional Irish folk tunes and songs, mm-hmm. with some of her own compositions as well. And she's actually quite good about putting poems to music. Mm. So if you are an Anne of Green Gables fan by any chance, and you ever wanted to memorize The Highwayman like Anne, then Lorena McKennitt has put it compellingly to music and made it much more easy to memorize.
Highwayman came riding, right.
Yeah. I was going to harmonize.
Oh, sorry. Well, anyway, she does it great.
She does. Perhaps we'll sing for you on a different podcast.
Perhaps indeed.
We're not. But I think she's a fascinating singer and writer because she loves to immerse herself in the folk history of the music she sings. And she chose the Celtic world as her entry point. And it's really interesting. If you read on her website, she'll say the Celtic world was one entry point that she got on to discover different local musics, and but her interest is in tracing the roots of culture and of kind of the history of a people through the music that they make. And I have found such beauty in her music, and I think that one of the things I love about her music, and I think this is very rich in the Celtic idea of the world, is a sense of longing. And I think that often in the Christian faith, and this is not explicitly Christian music in any sense, but I think that something that's sometimes missing from our modern account of faith is that there's great room within faith for longing and for doubt and for desire, because we live in the in-between world. We kind of live in these shadowlands, as C.S. Lewis would say. And I think that a real central element of Celtic thought was that we are pilgrims. And that's a real part of even the Celtic Christian church was there were the peregrinatio, the monks that would go out, that were sent, they felt, by God to be pilgrims in the world, founding monasteries, bringing the gospel. And so there was a deep sense of journeying, I think, in the Celtic church and the Celtic view of the world. And I think that for me, is really reflected in kind of the yearning of Lorena McKennitt's music and her sense of coming up against mystery, of living in the presence of something beautiful beyond her.
Well, if faith is to move towards the unseen object, what else will keep you going except for longing for it?
Well, exactly. And so in some ways, I see this music, Lorena McKennitt, I mean, I will say I love all Celtic music pretty much. John Mock. William Coulter is a beautiful acoustic Celtic artist. But I think a real common part of this music is this sense of journeying and this sense of calling out to the deeps and the yearning within the human heart. And so I think Lorena McKennitt's Elemental and The Visitor, I think I love her earliest albums the best. There's still kind of this almost natural elemental beauty to Elemental. That was just
there you go.
Her CD.
And I'll just pop in here kind of thinking about this tradition of music, and it's great. It's longing and it's beauty. I've noticed this a lot actually more in being in Scotland, because this kind of music, I used to think of it as kind of like, you know, the lone person picking away the guitar, but it's very much a part of Celtic culture still.
Yes. Oh, very much.
And
so.
I have my good friend Marjorie and several other people who on the weekends will just go with their friends or their cousins and just go play traditional Scottish music in pubs.
I love that.
And there's all of these preserved, again, it's still kind of oral, these preserved melodies that everyone knows.
They're passed down. It's communal.
It is,
sense.
Very much.
Deeply communal.
And music still very much is for them. You can just go, and there's a pub in our town called The Waypat, where you can just go and bring your violin on a Tuesday night and know that people will be playing music. And it was funny because the other day I was on a train, and then I'll let you talk more about Marie McKenna if you have things to say, but I was on a train and there was this really older gentleman, and he was, it was really funny because he kept on trying to make eye contact with me, and I was kind of like not in the mood to be made eye contact with. I had my big old headphones on, but I finally realized I couldn't avoid it. And so he pointed at my computer, and I have this little sticker that one of your listeners is probably listening to this sent me, Katie. I think it was Katie that sent me this, that says Wisconsin, milk farmers. Do you know that I have this on my computer?
No, I don't.
Well, anyway, he was like, do you know people in Wisconsin? And I was like, only with a Scottish accent. And I said, yeah, I do. And so anyway, started talking, and he knew someone, but somehow we started talking about music, and he was in his 90s. He had studied in the 50s, I think, at St. Andrews Pure Maths. And he said, well, one of the things I love most is doing traditional music. So I started to ask him about that. And he said, you know, so much of traditional music, he said, is about death and about longing. It's reckoning with the... He said, I don't quite know why. He said, but it is. It's all about dying and about loving people and about longing for things.
Very good accent.
Thank you. And I just thought that was so interesting, because it was just to hear him say that, when that was the thing that had always kind of called out to me about Celtic music, was the sense of being moved towards the eternal and it being a wonderful thing, but also kind of mysterious and almost a frightful thing.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, the only other thing I think I'd really add, and this ties actually right into what you're saying, is I think that my whole area of study right now is theodicy. So like, how do we make sense of the suffering and the evil of the world if we say that God is good and that God is our creator? And I think I actually have realized I've learned to walk with and to sit with sorrow in a way with the Celtic imagination in a way that I think the modern world hasn't helped me to do. And I think that they took sorrow in their stride. They didn't they weren't surprised by the brokenness of the world. They saw this as a story in which we are living in the broken place where the battle rages.
Yeah.
But there's movement in their music. And I think if you look at the history of the Celtic peoples, this is tragic. There's huge
ancient and modern.
Yeah, and there's a sadness, I think, to those cultures as well. There's a sadness, and yet there's this persistent, stubborn celebration as well. And I think that that's what I love in the tension in Celtic music between the sorrowing and the hopeful, the grieved and the heart that continues to go on, this unwillingness to be done with the world.
A heart who is broken by the beauty of the world, because they both see the brokenness but also the great beauty.
I mean, there's
in
this journeying. I think music is a way of journeying.
It pulls you towards
this continual hope.
I feel like there's the quote from Persuasion where it says, I am half agony, half hope. My mom recently got me a mug with that on it.
Oh, but, me too.
Yes, there we go. She said, it reminded me of you. And I was like, thanks, Mom. Anyway, but I feel like Celtic music is half agony, half hope.
I think that is very true. And I think that's where its power lies. And I think it's where we need it in this day and age, to be honest.
Because I feel like our world is so kind of awash with reasons to have sorrow. But
we don't know what to do with
it. We have no idea what to do with it. So we either just like drown it or get depressed. So in some ways, I feel like Celtic music kind of creates a space to sorrow and to long and to see hope at the end as well.
And to journey on.
Yes. So my friends, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. I was so fun to do it with you, Sarah. Thank you for coming on.
I got to come. Thank you.
And I think we'll have to do more in the future.
I would be very up for that.
Hopefully it's been a very crazy week. Hopefully when no one has colds, when all babies are sleeping.
Sorry if there's some sniffliness.
When no one's visiting. Anyway, no, we have so
much
fun.
That will never happen. So we probably better just do it.
Anyway, we hope that you have a beautiful week of peace and delight. Go find some of these resources and enjoy them. And I'm going to end today with a song by Lorena McKinnitt.
How lovely.
Yes. So have a beautiful day, and I will talk to you all soon.
she stepped away from me, and this she did say, it will not be long, love, till our wedding day. She stepped away from me, who are saying no to where we're wed, but one glance of sorrow that never was said, and she smiled.